Thank you very much, Ajahn Pram. If you have questions, write it down. Can I see the hands of the people who collect the questions? There's one in the back of the room.
There is a special prize tonight for the best question, and the prize is a free haircut from me. Monkstar.
Okay. Anyway, I have now three questions in the list. Then the first one is, why are five precepts important to meditation?
The question is, why are five precepts important to meditation? And the reason is that in order to make you happy. Strange thing that people think if you're naughty, you're happier. But obvious, if you want a good time, then be good. Makes sense to me. Do you want to have a good time in life? I'm a good time monk. I have a good time because I'm good. So keeping five precepts is a way of avoiding problems in life. For those of you men who think you can play around with other girls, and you always think you'll never get caught, you always get, your wife isn't that stupid. She knows the signs. You always do get caught. Stop doing that. You create problems for yourself and others. And the same with drinking. You know, sometimes in Thailand they say, well, just drinking a little bit, is that okay? So I say, well, if it's only a little bit, it's okay. So you can kill a little bit and that'll be okay. Stealing a little bit is okay. A little bit of adultery is okay. Is it? Of course not. But people always say about drinking. So it's much better to keep the precepts. Save a lot of money from divorce lawyers. You know, recently I know that some of you may have heard that if you have alcohol, it's good for your heart because it reduces cholesterol. Last year, that was disproved. That was not good science. The findings, it's obviously a lot of wishful thinking. But what was found only recently, because only about a month ago I read this, every time you take alcohol, you reduce your brain size. And it's true. Every drink of alcohol, your brain shrinks. And I think they said it's something about 2.5% if you drink every day. By about 30, 40 years, your brain size is 2.5% less than the average. You're stupid to start drinking, but even more stupid after a long time of drinking. So when you only use 10% of your brain anyway, 2.5% is quite considerable. But be careful. The key to five precepts, it's simple, and you're happier. For young people in the West, like I tell them, I gave up drinking when I was a student. I had more fun when I gave up drinking. Now, this is not monk talk, because this is just what I tell young people to try and get them to stop taking alcohol and drugs. When you go out to dances, to parties, to nightclubs, you know, as a young man, you'd find a nice young girl. Young girls want to sort of pair off with a guy. When I went to parties and drank, the best part of a party, when you met your girl, you're sitting in a corner. I won't tell you what you were doing, because you all know what that was. I didn't remember what I was doing. I wasn't aware and mindful, so I never enjoyed it. I couldn't remember what I was up to. When I stopped drinking, I was fully mindful, and I really enjoyed that part of the night. So listen, if you really are going out, and you want to enjoy yourself, isn't it the case that the less you drink, if you don't drink at all, you don't take any of these terrible drugs, you're more alert, more aware, you actually enjoy yourself more. So why do people drink? It's crazy stuff to do. That's why the old story over here. I know that so many Thai people are afraid of ghosts. You're afraid of ghosts? There's one ghost you should be very afraid of. This is a ghost, a real ghost. People sometimes ask you as a monk, have you ever seen P? This is a ghost which I have seen many times. This is a ghost which does possess people. I've seen people possessed by this ghost, and they speak in a very strange way. You know when, like possessions, like in the movies, you speak you're completely out of character. The very strange voice, and you don't act like you normally do. And sometimes I've seen this ghost kill people. Even here in Thailand. It's the most dangerous ghost in the world. It's called the bottle ghost. It lives in bottles of Mekong and Singha beer. As soon as you open the top, the bottle ghost possesses you. Makes you say strange things, walk in a strange way, and even kills you on the road. That's why we call these things spirits. Okay, so it's very good. It makes you more happy, more peaceful, more mindfulness.
Second question. What is the best way to approach meditation and meditation retreat if we are not used to sitting a long time and actually we're used in living a life in the fast lane?
Okay, if you're living life in the fast lane, this is actually recorded on the tape when you ask these questions?
Yes.
Oh, it is, okay, so I don't need to repeat them. Okay, if you're living life in the fast lane, you've got to go down the gears slowly. If you're in a fast lane and you put your feet on the brakes, you're going to go through the windscreen. So that's why in meditation, if you're going in the fast lane, when you start meditation, go into it gently. In this retreat which I gave in Sydney many years ago, an executive came on that retreat. She came late in the evening because she had to finish her work in Sydney. She was a very powerful businesswoman. But she was smart. She had heard what I said, and I said, look, take it easy for the first 3 days. So what she did, we used to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. She stayed in bed till breakfast at 7. She got up for breakfast, and after breakfast went to bed again. She did that for 3 days. She also had a nap after lunch. And I told her to do that. Because she was in a dormitory with other girls, she told me in interviews, those other girls, they were looking at her with sheer hatred. I said, it's not hatred, it's jealousy. They only wish they had the guts to do what you're doing. And I praised her on that retreat because for 3 days she slept and slept and slept. It's what we call in medicine sleep deficit. And many of you, if you're in a fast lane, have sleep deficit. So usually the first couple of days you just rest, take it easy. What I call meditating flat out. And then after you rested, this lady, when she rested, she'd slowed down, going through the gears slowly until she was going very slowly. Then she started to meditate. The next 3 days, she soon caught up with all the other meditators. And the final 3 days of that 9-day retreat, she'd overtaken them all. She was one of the star meditators. She knew how to make peace with her body. If you're tired, take a rest. If you're meditating and sitting down, meditate, don't say half an hour or 5 minutes. Meditate as long as you feel comfortable. And then, when you're not comfortable anymore, move and do something else. That's not copping out. If you do that mindfully and carefully and gently, you'll find that you'll ease yourself into meditation gently. And then it won't be Anapanasati, it'll be proper Buddhist meditation. Haven't you heard from Thai monks the Buddha was the compassionate one, the kind one? Do you think the Buddha would teach meditation making you hurt and forcing you to sit for hours and hours and hours? You must all know what Ajahn Chah said about sitting meditation for long periods of time. He said, if sitting meditation for long periods of time was a cause for enlightenment, then all the chickens in Thailand would be arahats by now, because they sit for hours without moving on those eggs. So if you sit for long periods of time, you call that chicken meditation. You might hatch something, but you never get peaceful or enlightened. So be gentle, be wise. So if you're in the fast lane, and you go on a meditation retreat, gently, calmly, kindly, you get yourself into meditation. And that way that people aren't afraid of meditation. And that way that people develop their meditation gently. And that, you know, is the fastest way. If you push yourself, you're just wasting time. With kindness and gentleness, you get into deep meditation. It's happy meditation. And it gets so powerful, stillness. It's called middle way. Avoiding extremes. That's why it's important to teach this way. I've taught this way for many years and got huge success. Not only in my own meditation, but other people's meditation. Taking people into jhanas. It's great when that happens. And they go, yeah, this is how it's done. Don't push. That's just ego controlling. It's reinforcing the sense of self. It's not letting go. Doing more things. Gently, gently, gently. Softly, softly. It's the fastest way.
Next question. When is the best time to start meditate?
It's always now, isn't it? Now is the only time you have. So if you put it off till tomorrow, then you put it off till tomorrow, you'll be dead before you meditate. So it's worthwhile investing a little bit of time. It's not that much, and you make up that time afterwards. It's called efficiency. This is what I've been saying in business conference. A busy person is not someone who gets lots done. A busy person is someone who does too many things at the same time. And I've seen some people, they're just so effective in life. They get so much done. It doesn't seem like they're doing anything. Because they are efficient. There is no efficient because they're mindful. They're happy what they're doing. They can put passion and energy into it because they've got powerful mind. That's why I'm saying happiness is the cause for success, not the other way around. So if you can build up your inner happiness through meditation, wow, you're going to be such a successful person.
What should I do if I keep falling asleep when attempting meditation?
What should you do when you go to sleep when you're meditating? Go to proper sleep. Enjoy it. You're tired. Be kind. Don't fight the sleepiness. The reason why you keep on getting sleepy when you meditate is because you're trying to stay awake. So don't control the mind. Make peace with it. Work with it. Flow with it. If you're very, very tired, it's good to sit and just allow the mind to just be dull. If you make peace without dullness, you allow it to be, you don't fight it, you just, with whatever little bit of awareness you have, you just watch it. But you're kind to it. You open the door of your heart to your sleepiness. It doesn't last that long then. But when you fight it and try and control it and try and get rid of it, that lasts for a long time. It's the same, the opposite. Have you ever gone to bed at night and you can't sleep? That's another problem these days. People have got insomnia. When they meditate, they like to fall asleep. When they go to bed, they can't go asleep. Crazy people these days. So if you are like that, remember, what is the most comfortable place in your house? It's your bed. You know what it's like when you wake up in the morning? Do you like to get out of bed? Oh, it's so cozy and so warm and so nice. So if you're in your bed at night, you can't go to sleep. Great! I can enjoy the most comfortable place in my whole house. So that's what I did once, because at a time about 2 or 3 years ago, I'm not sure why it was, but I found it sometimes difficult to go to sleep at night. I had to do many things in the morning. So I tried and tried and tried to get to sleep, and it made me more awake. And obviously I thought, stupid, you should know what's going on. So I decided, no, this is the most comfortable place, you know, sleeping in my bed. So I thought, I don't want to go to sleep. I'm going to enjoy this. It's comfortable. You know, not sitting cross-legged. You can lay on your side, stretch out. Oh, it's so nice. And no one's asking me any questions or asking to sign any books. Oh, this was bliss. You know, that tell a story. I was in Singapore about a year and a half ago, coming back from United States. And it's a long trip from LA, and I was so tired because I've been teaching so much in the United States. And as soon as I was met at the gate, because I got many disciples who worked for Singapore Airlines, so they met me at the gate and took me for breakfast, I think in one of the lounges. And the last thing I wanted was to be asked questions on Dhamma. And I spent about, I don't know how many, 2 or 3 weeks in the United States working really hard, you know, talking about Dhamma and meditation. And I was really jet-lagged and tired because I never sleep well on planes. And I got there and they started asking me questions on Dhamma. And I thought, how can I get a bit of peace without offending all these wonderful people from Singapore who'd met me? So I said, I need to go to the toilet. So I went into the toilet in Changi Airport Lounge. And as soon as I walked in, the toilet attendant said, Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, can I ask you a question about meditation? Oh, it's terrible. Even in the toilet, I can't get any peace. So I decided just to let go and just allow it to happen. It was actually very nice because the toilet attendant, he wanted to make a donation. And I wrote the address down on a piece of toilet paper for him. And now I've got a letter about 2 weeks later with, I think, 20 Singapore dollars. That was wonderful. It almost made me cry. Because toilet attendants don't get paid very much. And he was just so kind and generous. So he gave like a $20 donation to our monastery. Oh, that was so wonderful. I really enjoyed that. So anyhow, that's actually... What was the question anyway? I forgot. Anyway, it's good enough. Yeah, next question.
What is the best way to deal with anxiety during meditation?
The best way to deal with anxiety in meditation is when you have fear, fear is always about losing something. So what are you afraid to lose? So when you get fear and anxiety in meditation, just look at yourself. What am I not wanting to let go of or allow to disappear? And when you actually find out what that is, what you're afraid of losing, because all fear is fear of losing something, you can find out, I'll let go a little bit more and see what it's like. You know that meditation is the safest thing you could possibly do in your life. It's actually not meditating you should be afraid of. When you don't meditate, that's when you get stress and you get cancers and you get blood pressure, high blood pressure, and all these other problems in life. You know that you can see that, you know, that monks like me are expanding. I always say that's because Buddhism is expanding in Australia, and so am I, you know, just to keep up with it. But one thing which we did find out last year was that when you are happy and you laugh, your arteries actually dilate. Arteries get bigger. They get wider. But when you get miserable and upset and stressed out, your arteries actually contract. Which is why, if you ever notice, fat people are always happy. You always get jolly fat people, don't you? You know why that is? Because if you're fat and worry a lot, then both together, you've got too much cholesterol and your arteries contract, then you're a goner. So only happy people who are fat survive. So if you are overweight, a bit of meditation and a lot of laughter will balance the effects of being overweight. It's much better than going on a diet. So it's actually, this is why if we are happy, we get less anxiety, less fear, and also if you're anxious, you're always anxious about something which is going to happen next. And a lot of time that anxiety is irrational. For example, what was it? Just saying something nice about the wonderful people in Singapore up the top there in the higher realms. That once I went to Singapore to teach at Suntec City Convention Center. I think you'd hired the center for about 4 or 5 days, I think 4 days, 4 talks, at great expense. But it was in the middle of the SARS crisis. When I arrived at Changi Airport, I'd actually read in the newspaper on the plane from Perth to Singapore, and it said something like 99 people had got SARS, or maybe even died from SARS, I forget which. And it was so bad that the government had closed all the schools and had asked people to have no public meetings. And so all the supporters have put in a lot of money to hire the convention center. I think it's 3,000 or 4,000 seats. They said, should we cancel? I said, what are you afraid of? I said, look, they've got SARS. I said, listen, I think 99 people have died of SARS. What's the population of Singapore? They said, 3 million. That means 2,999,901 people haven't got SARS. When I put it that way, they weren't afraid. What's the odds? It's about, is it 30,000 to 1 against getting SARS. That's pretty good odds. Let's go ahead. So we did go ahead. Anxiety and fear is actually seeing, you know, in that story of the two bad bricks in the wall, just seeing the two bad bricks of the future and not having it in perspective. So the best way of coping with anxiety is just to be in the present moment. You've got nothing to worry about. If it's all going to go wrong, it's going to go wrong anyway. If you're going to die, you might as well enjoy your last few moments. As Ajahn Chah always used to say, when you're in a hospital, he said this to many monks, he said this to me when I had typhus fever, as many of our monks did have. It was at Christmas time, and I felt so depressed, you know, when you got this terrible fever. And I think, I don't know if it was actually Christmas Day or just the day afterwards, Ajahn Chah came to see me in hospital. The great master come to see me. And I thought, so inspired and uplifted, until the great master opened his mouth. And you know what he said? He said, Brahma Wang, so you'll either get better or you're going to die. And then he left. Thank you so much. But why get worried? My disease wasn't going to last that long. I'd either die or I'd get better. So nothing to worry about. So in meditation, you've got nothing to worry about at all. Don't be anxious. Stay in the present moment, and anxiety just cannot find you in the present moment. If you wander off into the future, you'll get even more afraid. And the best way for looking after the future is to care about the present. Because now is where the future is made. By caring about the now, this present moment, you're doing the very, very best to ensure a safe, happy, prosperous future.
Is language a big problem in studying Buddhism? For example, for your own experience, learning Dhamma in Thailand with Ajahn Chah without knowing any Thai at all.
Oh, yeah, we had great fun with Ajahn Chah not knowing Thai. But I had to learn very quickly. Because I remember once going up, because in the early days with Ajahn Chah, this was in Wat Pa Phong, before Wat Nana Chat started, there were very, very few requisites. Now, sometimes we'd run out of batteries for the torches, and he didn't have any. Or sometimes he didn't have any sandals. And once, you know, what happened, that in his little hut, he'd have those old water jars they used to have, you know, they still have in the Northeast. And any requisites which had got, he put in the water jar. And that was actually the storeroom, was like a jar. Toothpaste, batteries, and if you went to ask for anything, he'd just look and see if you had it. And he'd give it to you, because we shared everything. And one day I needed some soap. And the word for soap is sabu. But I got it wrong, I said sapo. And Ajahn Chah said sapo, because it means pineapple. Saparot. And he said to me, he said, pineapple, what do you want pineapple for? He said it in Thai. And I said, to wash. And of course Ajahn Chah just laughed his head off. Because he was just learning about Western culture. He never realized that in the West people wash with pineapples. He never let me forget that. But I learned two words that day. I really learned, never forgot the word for pineapple and the word for soap. So it's great fun learning And this is why actually when you make it fun, you enjoy it, you laugh with whatever you do. There's an old saying which I learned when I was a school teacher. If you make a mistake, especially in front of a class or when you're giving a lecture, if you make a mistake and people laugh, then you laugh as well. That way the world never laughs at you, it only laughs with you. It never laughs at you, it laughs with you. And it was one of my great services for my teacher. What the Western monks did for Ajahn Chah is give him many, many occasions of laughter at our stupidity. So he had a great time with Western monks, the stupid things we got up to, and the language problems we had. But it was no real problem there. I know that, do you remember Dr. Sanya Tamasak? He was a prime minister of Thailand for about a week, a caretaker prime minister. He was the Ongam Montri. He was also a very devout Buddhist. He once came up to Ajahn Chah, because I was there at the time, and asked Ajahn Chah, said, you can't speak any English. You've got so many Western disciples. How do you teach them? And that's when he said, oh, teaching Westerners is easy. It's just like training water buffalo. You pull them this way, you push them that way until they're experienced. So that's how he trained us, like water buffalo. Because water buffalo, they can't understand Thai or Pasa Isan. But they can be trained, just like husbands can be trained. You just push them this way, you pull them that way until they can do what you want. Like monks. That's how he trained us.
Can you please say a few words about intellectual study and inquiry and the development of intuitive wisdom? At times they feel like opposing forces.
Okay, yeah, intellectual wisdom and also experiential wisdom. This is an important question, a wonderful question. Because sometimes intellectual knowledge is useful, like for clearing the path. Now, using reason to stop stupidity. For example, I know that there's a big thing now in Thailand of this Chatukam, all these medallions. And I come off it. That's called superstition. You should all know the story when one day someone came to see Ajahn Chah. And they asked for a little Buddha to put around their neck because they were drafted into the Thai army. And at that time there were still skirmishes on the border, especially between the Laos and Cambodian border. Many of the Thai soldiers were being wounded and killed. It was dangerous. So this young man, drafted into the Thai army, asked Ajahn Chah for a little medallion to protect him from bullets. And Ajahn Chah said, look, we don't do that. This is forest monks. This is not our tradition. This is superstition. But then this young man reminded Ajahn Chah, he'd just given a sermon about gratitude. Gatanyu. And he said, listen, I've been giving you all this food, looking after you, helping you. I've given all this food to you. The least you can do to me is to give me a Buddha statue to protect me from bullets. What do you mean about talking about gratitude? You won't do this. So Ajahn Chah said, okay. In that case, I will give you a Buddha to put around your neck. And Ajahn Chah said, I guarantee this will protect you from bullets when you go in the army. And a man was so pleased. This was the only time I've known Ajahn Chah give somebody a Buddha and actually tell them it will protect you from bullets. Ajahn Chah, it says, the big Buddha in the main hall. Hang that around your neck, and that will protect you from bullets. It's the same here in Thailand. People always, in the buses, they put you in the front seat. You know why? When I was in Thailand living here, I was traveling from Chonburi, to Bangkok, and they put me in the front seat of this bus. And as soon as I walked in, the bus driver smiled from ear to ear. Because I was in the very front, right next to the window, because there was a movie on the TV in the bus. And so driving down that highway, this driver was looking at the movie. He wasn't looking at the traffic because he was depending upon me and my good karma to save him from crashes. It's the most scary trip I've ever taken. I obviously had some good karma because he didn't crash. He came close a few times. You know that you always put the mic in the front because their good karma will protect the people at the back? I tried that when I was flying on Thai Airways once on economy class. I said, look, if you put me in the front, it will save you from crashes. They didn't believe that. It's worth a try. They never upgraded me. It's all superstition. But the problem is, superstition is dangerous. This is why there was, this reached Australia, it was in the newspapers, a general in the Thai army, must have been about 10, 15 years ago, who bought a medallion, you know, from the market by Wat Mahathat, 500,000 US. Guaranteed to protect you from bullets. He was in, you know, the army club or mess, whatever it's called, been drinking Mekong and a whiskey, and he was boasting about this medallion he'd bought for $500,000 US. He said, this protects me from bullets. And he gave his revolver to a major and ordered him to shoot him to show how this bullet would protect him from bullets, from wounds. So the major, under orders, took the revolver, pulled the trigger, and shot the general dead. The general died because of superstition. And many other people die because of superstition. Because they have medallions, they think that's going to protect them, which makes you heedless. Superstition is not just a benign thing. It's a dangerous thing. It kills many people because they think the medallion will protect them. Or they get a monk to bless their car and they think now they're safe from police cameras or for speeding or from accidents. It means you are not being careful. You think the monk's blessing is going to protect you. That's the danger of superstition. It does actually kill people. So be careful about that. Otherwise, you know, it's your karma. You make karma. You be careful and heedful. You'll be successful and safe. Okay.
The happiness resulting from meditation, how do you know you are not just generating lopa?
Generating lopa. This is a great question because the Buddha taught there are two types of happiness in this world. This is in the Ranavibhanga Sutta, if anyone wants to check me out. He said you should distinguish between pleasures. There are pleasures of the world, what he calls amissa sukha, which are dangerous. The reason they're dangerous is because they disappear too quickly. They don't last. And they're very hard to get. Often they're at the expense of other people. But there are other pleasures, the inner pleasures of the mind. He said monks do not just monks, nuns, lay people, don't be afraid of those pleasures. Enjoy those pleasures. Because those are the pleasures of the mind which lead to always good things. Now the pleasure of like being kind, being compassionate, being good. You know what it's like when you help somebody and you serve them? You do something kind for somebody else. I've already mentioned, you know, when that toilet attendant gave me gave our monastery $20. That gave me so much happiness to see someone do something good. That's good happiness. You don't need to be afraid of the happiness of generosity, of kindness, of love, of peace, of inspiration, nor about the happiness of meditation. The Buddha actually taught that if you indulge and get attached to the happiness of meditation, you can expect one of four results. Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full arahat, full enlightenment. By being attached to the four, by being attached to the joys of meditation, you just become enlightened. So that's well worthwhile attaching to. Go for it. Enjoy it. There's nothing wrong with it. Isn't it wonderful to have a happiness, a joy, which is not dangerous, which just makes you a more calm, peaceful, good, healthy person? And that's meditation. It's not low, but it is desire, it is craving, because you do get attached to those states. It's good to get attached to. Only next time you get in there, you have to let go to be able to get in there. There are stages of letting go. Happiness born of peace, not happiness born of wanting.
What should come first, sti or samadhi, and why? What should come first, sati or samadhi, and why?
What should come first, sati or samadhi? Sati is mindfulness, samadhi is stillness. They both go together. You cannot really say one leads and the other one goes behind. When you are still, you become more mindful. When you are mindful, you become more still. Now, this is something which very few people teach. It's the different levels of awareness and mindfulness. I actually coined the words power mindfulness and superpower mindfulness. Right, for many people, as I said, it's like looking through the window of a speeding car. That's your life. And you see so little, you feel so little. And life is sometimes dull. It doesn't have any sort of power or meaning for, or even passion to it. When you slow down, just the life becomes more meaningful, more interesting, more beautiful, the colors are better, the tastes are better, everything just brightens up in your life. What you're getting there is power mindfulness. You see deeply into things, you get more taste out of it. And as that meditation gets more and more still, the mindfulness gets stronger and stronger. You appreciate life more. You appreciate food more. People who are depressed, they can't taste food. They look at things and it's boring. Even like TV programs they used to like doesn't get to them anymore. Nothing satisfies them in depression because your mindfulness is just so weak. That's actually a good definition of depression. Very weak mindfulness. But when your mindfulness starts to get empowered with stillness, with samadhi, that's what I've been using recently. The best translation of that word samadhi is stillness. Don't call it concentration, please. I know that's an English word which has been used, but concentration to me stands for concentration camps. And sometimes some meditation retreats are like that, with the monks like Gestapo officers making you sit for hours on end. That's not what meditation is. So when you call it stillness, it's much more descriptive of the meaning of the word samadhi. It also tells you how to get into samadhi by not doing things, because when you are active, you're not still. When you stop and are still, all these mindfulnesses, they go stronger and stronger. It's a wonderful experience in meditation retreats. The food tastes nicer. You go out and see the flowers, and wow, those flowers are so, so beautiful. More beautiful than you've ever seen before. Nothing to do with the flowers, but your mindfulness is now strong. You're in life, you're enjoying life. And if you're in some business, you're more alert. You can pick up the signs from your customers, your clients. You're far more successful because you're more sensitive. Your mindfulness increases. Literally, your mind becomes more and more powerful, more and more effective. You see deeper into things than your competitors. This is the competitive edge for the success of business in Bangkok, sponsored by the Ministry of Economic Affairs. Another question, couple of questions?
Yes, I may need help on this. Thank you for the talk. You said you can be happy no matter what you are going through. It's written that. Isn't this emphasis on being happy a recipe for repression and denial?
Aha.
Then it said, when bad things happen, like violence against you, death or loved ones, etc., your feelings or grief or unhappiness is natural. Is that what you wrote?
Okay, it's a great question. It's saying that when things go wrong in your life, when people say bad things about you, or when you may lose a loved one, do you have to get unhappy? And it's wonderful actually to see people who refuse to get unhappy. When my father died, I never cried. I looked at his death. I loved that man enormously. I looked upon his death like a concert which had just ended. And as a young man going to concerts in England, in London, I never cried after a great concert. I felt gratitude instead. A lot of times, if we just change our attitude to what we have to be with, the suffering disappears. The teaching which I give, and I'm going to use coarse language, I know Ajahn Chah used the word ki a lot. The equivalent English word is shit. So I'm going to use that word because the Buddha actually said in the Vinaya that the Dharma should be taught in the local language. If you tread in the dog shit, you should never scrape it off your shoes or sandals. Don't do that. Instead, take it back to your house, to your home, and scrape it off under the mango tree. And dig it under that mango tree. And 1 year later, your mangoes will be sweeter than ever before. But when you eat those mangoes, please remember what you're eating. Dog shit transformed. Now that's actually how we look at life. Now if you don't mind me saying, the dog shit of life. You know, when things do go wrong, when the people who you love mistreat you or cheat you. These are real life experiences. But what are you going to do about that if you allow yourself to suffer with these things? You're not knowing the proper Dharma way of learning from these situations. When you understand that, as the Buddha said, there are two arrows which we get shot by, the physical arrow and the mental arrow. The world is like this and we cannot really change that world. People die, they will cheat us, we get disappointed, we'll be separated from our loved ones. That's the dukkha of the world. But the only escape from that dukkha is we can't do much to change that world. We try our best, but no matter how hard you try, things will always go wrong. No matter how careful you are, you'll tread in the dog shit from time to time. But the point is, the other arrow, the mental suffering, our reaction to what we have to experience in life, that we are in full control of. We don't have to suffer with what happens to us in our life, even physical pain. Great monks, great nuns, great meditators, it's amazing, and I've seen this many times. Physically, they should be in great pain. But because of the strength of their mind, they can be smiling and happy, and you wouldn't know what physical pain they're going through. They're not suppressing that. They're dealing it with wisdom, with mindfulness, and letting it be. They're opening the door of their heart to the pain of life. They're making peace rather than war. That's the way out of suffering. The answer is, great question, but yes, it can be done. It was done by the Buddha. It's been done even these days. It's called being enlightened. It's a happiness through meditation. The Buddha could do it. Monks and nuns have done it. Why can't you? It's not repression. It's understanding. It's liberation.